To hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll be talking with Judy McCaffrey and Shirley Walsh about the never-ending saga of the Jordan Cove LNG terminal in Coos Bay. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Gerald Biafro. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and the time now is just 11 o'clock. KBOO's Kickstarter is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. KBOO's Kickstarter campaign will help build a strong infrastructure for the next generation of culture workers and DJs. Please spread the word to your friends that we need to raise funds to support our future media makers. Thank you for supporting KBOO through Kickstarter today at kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And now, stay tuned for Making Contact, who discusses law enforcement history as a tool of social control and asks if it's time to consider the end of policing.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Community Advisory Board will meet Tuesday, February 20th at 5:30 p.m.
When radio got taken over by advertising, people in Portland decided to do it themselves. And in 1968, they created a space that was free from advertisers and independent from corporate or mainstream media interest. KBOO Community Radio. This is the very essence of DIY culture. And KBOO was there in the 70s as people were taking back music spaces. In the 80s, when artists were taking back music distribution. And in the 90s, supporting Zine and small press revolution and all movements of self-expression. Help us build a city of artistic media makers. Long live DIY radio and join us on Kickstarter today. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Community radio is radio for the people, by the people. At KBOO, your neighbors, coworkers, and friends make radio so you can be sure that the issues they bring to you are the issues that matter. We believe strong communities invest in sharing knowledge with each other. Every month, KBOO offers free classes in the art of radio broadcasting so Portland can stay informed. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
This week on Making Contact.
When you have an economic system that says that wealth and inequality is because some people are more qualified than others, not because of the failure of market forces, then the solution is forcing those who are on the losing end to behave themselves and accept their diminished position, kind of blaming the victim. And because if we were to admit that market forces had something to do with this rise of inequality, then we'd have to do something about those market forces.
We broadcast an episode of the Upstream Podcast, a conversation with Professor of Sociology, Alex Vitali, author of the book, The End of Policing. I'm your host, RJ Lozada. Stay tuned. Alex Vitali is Professor of Sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. His book, The End of Policing, is an accessible study of police history as an imperial tool for social control that continues to exacerbate class and racial tensions. Vitali also goes deep into the shortcomings of reform and, in contrast, deepens the conversations around meaningful alternatives to ultimately ask the reader to consider the end of policing. Upstream producer Robert Raymond spoke with Vitali at his home in Brooklyn, New York.
So there has been a growing awareness around the problems with policing in the United States in the last several years. Thanks in part to the work of Black Lives Matter and also because of things like cell phone cameras and videos. And so this awareness has sparked a debate about what to do about excessive police force and a lack of police accountability within the criminal justice system. Much of this debate focuses on various kinds of reform, but in your work, you actually argue against the idea that mere reform is enough. Your argument against reform includes a number of different yet related dimensions, including both a historical and structural analysis of policing. I'd like to focus on the dark historical origins of the police in the first half of our conversation, and then really dive into the structural analysis in the second half. So first, it might be helpful just for you to briefly provide an outline of your general thesis on why you think police reform is a dead end.
Sure. I think that we fail to understand the fundamental nature of policing when we suggest that things like body cameras and community policing and hiring a few additional black police officers is somehow going to fundamentally change the mission and the scope of policing. We should be always mindful of the fact that of all the resources that the government, the state, has available to use to solve problems, the police are the most coercive and the most punitive, along with prisons, jails, courts, etc. And so those resources should always be used as a last resort. And so in every circumstance, we should be asking ourselves, are there solutions to our problems that can be solved without relying on that coercive state force? And what I attempt to show in the book is that a lot of what police do can be done in other ways without all the negative collateral consequences of arresting people, giving people tickets, issuing all kinds of fines, making threats, using force against people. And that when people come to see the police as the primary tool for solving their problems, they are failing to take into account the historical legacy of policing in actually reproducing inequality, especially for communities of color, but also for poor whites. And that it's this history that needs to be made more clear.
So maybe we can dive into the history a little bit. You talk about three different areas from which modern-day policing emerged. So there's sort of the colonial era, and then moves on into slavery and industrial capitalism, all with their own unique sort of forms of policing. I want to take some time to get into each of these threads separately, so maybe can you start telling us the story, beginning with the sort of darker origins of policing in the colonial era?
So, first of all, I like to say that the problems with policing can be understood in kind of two ways. There is the part of the story that's hundreds of years old that has to do with the institutions of slavery, colonialism, and the suppression of the new industrial working class. And then there's a part of the story that's more recent that has to do with the war on drugs and the war on disorder and broken windows policing and the war on terror. So both of these elements are important in understanding why we should not be relying on the police as our primary tool for managing social problems. So often liberals will say, well, what's your big beef with the police? The police represented a professionalization of state social control mechanisms, shifting from informal watches, night watches, shifting from the use of militias to manage crowds, to a professional civilian police force. But what they leave out of that historical understanding is the fact that the very origins of those first civilian liberal professional police forces was actually the colonial administration of Ireland by England. So the first modern police we often refer to as the London Metropolitan Police, formed in 1829, and they were created by Sir Robert Peel. But Sir Robert Peel didn't come up with the idea of civilian police out of thin air. In fact, he had been in charge of the British occupation of Ireland that perpetuated a system of agricultural and economic peonage for the Irish people. It was deeply exploitative. It led to famines, etc. And for many years, that occupation was managed primarily by military forces. But over the course of the late 18th and early 19th century, there were foreign wars and foreign colonial expansions that became very expensive, that utilized heavily the existing military forces. And Peel also noted that constantly using the military to put down various rural outrages, as they were called, basically rebellions, lacked legitimacy and often stimulated further resistance. So to counter that, the lack of resources and the need for a more legitimate form of social control, he creates the Irish Peace Preservation Force, which looks a little bit like the militia and a little bit like modern policing. And what was distinctive about it was that it was more civilian in character and it was embedded in local communities and often took on some role in dealing with crime, but almost all crime during this period should be understood as crimes of the poor against the rich. Poor people stealing things from the rich or engaged in low-level rebellions or more serious rebellions. And what the Peace Preservation Force did is it tried to use its position within the community to intimidate, to gather intelligence, to be preventative in its activities so that they didn't have to call out the militia or the military and open fire on people. In the U.S., we have our own direct colonial linkages to policing. The Texas Rangers, which were a highly lauded force in the American South and Southwest, many books written, many movies, etc., lionizing them. But they were basically created to facilitate the expropriation of land in Texas from first indigenous populations and then from the Spanish and Mexican populations. And they carried out basically mass extermination campaigns against the native peoples. And this then became a model for frontier justice across the rest of the much of the United States. Also, the first state police force, the Pennsylvania State Police, was designed to manage the growing number of industrial and mining strikes happening in Pennsylvania a little over 100 years ago. The model for that police force was the U.S. occupation of the Philippines, which had occurred as a result of the Spanish-American War. So there's a long legacy of developing policing as a political tool in the interests of colonial relationships.
And so we see the rise of these police forces during the colonial era. And around the same time, we have slavery in this country. What role did policing play during the era of slavery?
Well, I think, again, we can understand the origins of policing as tied in part to the institution of slavery. Now, not in all parts of the country, obviously, but what you have is these different things going on simultaneously in different geographic regions, and there's overlap. So slavery produces a certain form of policing in the American South. Now, people will sometimes refer to slave patrols and say, well, that's policing. Liberal police scholars will say, well, that's not professional modern policing. That's something else. Yes, it was despicable, but now we have something very different. What I show in the book is that actually in urban southern areas like Charleston, South Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia, and New Orleans, you get the formation of what looks very much like modern civilian policing well before the London Metropolitan Police. But the primary but not sole responsibility of those forces is the management of mobile slave populations. When we think about slave patrols, we usually think about rural areas and men on horseback riding down country roads looking for escaped slaves, which was a major part of the function of those patrols. But in urban areas, slavery took a very different form. In these urban areas, slaves generally worked outside of the place that their owner lived. They worked in wharves, in warehouses, in factories, for wages. Sometimes they even received some of the wages for their own use, but the bulk of it returned to the slave owner. But what these cities were confronted with was the fact that there were now a huge population of slaves moving around freely within the city, and sometimes in conjunction with legally freed slaves who had the right to own property and have small businesses. And this created a tremendous anxiety among the white population that slaves would form underground societies, reading groups, religious organizations, political groups, speakeasies. And all of this, in fact, was going on in places like Charleston and New Orleans. And what this new modern police force was doing in Charleston as early as 1789, we have the Charleston City Guard that's wearing uniforms, professional, carrying out these law enforcement duties. But what they're enforcing primarily are the micro-regulation of these mobile slave populations. And the Charleston City Guard, after slavery, then becomes the Charleston Police Department. There's a fairly seamless transition there, and this is true in other parts of the South where what had been slave patrols then morph into local policing.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Making Contact. You're listening to an interview with Alex Vitale, author of The End of Policing, brought to us by the Upstream Podcast. For more information on Vitale or the Upstream Podcast, visit our site at radioproject.org.
So looking at the history of policing in the United States, it's not hard to see why we're in the situation that we are in right now with the police and with the United States having the largest population, I think both absolute and per capita of
That's right.
incarcerated individuals in the world. So maybe you could discuss what happened in the last century to lead us to being such a hyper-incarcerated society and how we can see the historical legacy of policing being played out now in our modern society.
Yeah, there really was a dramatic transformation. So for much of the 20th century, incarceration rates in the United States look basically flat and look a lot like Europe and other industrialized areas. But in the 1970s, there begins an abrupt upswing that continues up until just recently, just the most sustained and dramatic increase in incarceration rates. And what I'm interested in particular is the role of police in that process, and the tools that empowered police and encouraged police to be part of that trajectory. And police are not the only players. We know from Jonathan Pfaff's work that the role of DAs is incredibly important in explaining mass incarceration, and of course the changing of sentencing regimes by lawmakers. But what we've seen is this dramatic expansion in both the scope and intensity of policing along a broad number of fronts. So we have the war on drugs, we have the expansion of the enforcement of various kinds of vice laws, we have the rise of the policing of homeless populations, mentally ill populations, basically the creation and then rapid expansion of school policing, gang suppression policing, border policing. So in all these areas, for both individual reasons and then for some overarching reasons. Police have expanded the number of things they do, the powers they use, like the widespread creation of SWAT teams and other paramilitary forces. But all of this is tied to important political and economic transformations that begin in the 60s and 70s. And I think the best way to think about it is the interaction between neoliberal restructuring and neoconservative politics. So on the one hand, this is the period where we begin to see mass deindustrialization and a reshaping of the economy into a kind of post-industrial economy, where a fairly small number of workers who are directly tied to high finance, the management of multinational corporations and high-level business services for those sectors, those folks are making massive wages. They're enjoying huge tax cuts, deregulation. And at the same time, we have the replacement of an industrial, middle-class, unionized wage force with a service industry sector where wages are diminished, benefits are diminished, job security is diminished, so that people are unemployed, underemployed, sometimes overemployed, but at very low wages with no job security, so that people are taking two jobs, three jobs to try to make ends meet. And this, in turn, is producing high levels of disorder so that we have mass homelessness. I should say also what's also occurring is what we call, you know, government austerity, structural adjustment. So in order to provide subsidies, tax cuts, and incentives to high finance, multinational corporations, real estate industry, insurance, high-level business services, there's a hollowing out of social programs, of redistributive programs. The backlash against the welfare state that we see beginning in the Nixon administration. And then this is combined with an expansion of the social control functions of the state to manage this new disorderly and sometimes crime-prone communities. And so you get an expansion of criminal law. You get an increase in punitiveness within the system. You get an expansion of policing into more areas of everyday life. And none of this is really primarily about making us safer in some specific sense. It's more about managing these new dangerous classes, if you will.
So one thing that I wanted to get into, because it's just recently come back up, is the militarization of the police in the United States in particular. So the 1033 program, maybe if you could talk briefly about what that is and how it seems to be escalating under the Trump administration and how police can possibly justify needing grenade launchers and stuff like that.
So the militarization of policing has got a long arc. It goes back to the 1960s with the formation of SWAT teams, which were designed initially to deal largely with the political uprisings that were happening and the threat of, you know, armed insurrection movements from the Black Liberation Army and groups like that. So it always was very political, and it rarely had anything to do. It was really about the fear of these things that were incredibly rare occurrences, especially over the last 30 years. So instead, we've seen this increasing mission creep of these SWAT units. Instead of reducing their numbers, they've exploded. Peter Kraska's work at Eastern Kentucky is very important in documenting this. The number has exploded, the intensity of their work has exploded, and the armaments that they use, the scope of law enforcement they engage in. So now you've got SWAT teams all across the country serving, you know, low-level drug warrants at 4 a.m, bashing down doors, throwing in flashbang grenades because someone's suspected of having some pot in the house. This has led to deaths, the killing of pets, the injuries of small children, the killing of people who are completely innocent because the SWAT team's at the wrong address. And rather than challenging this, the Obama administration dramatically expanded it. The 1033 program allows for the direct transfer of military hardware from the Department of Defense to local police departments with almost no checks and balances. The Marshall Project recently created fake police departments and got millions of dollars of hardware sent to basically a PO box with no oversight, no monitoring, and they got all kinds of military hardware. They could have done whatever they wanted with it. In addition, even more money goes into Homeland Security terrorism grants to police departments, tens of billions of dollars for local police departments to buy military hardware from defense contractors. It's basically welfare for the defense industry. And all of this has contributed to an increasingly militarized mindset within policing that's being experienced as changes in training, changes in procedures, and the expansion and use of these paramilitary units. And all of this has contributed directly to the number of people being killed by police, the militarization of the policing of protests like we saw in Ferguson that was completely counterproductive.
More recently in St. Louis.
In St. Louis.
Where you had the police marching down the street in unison chanting, "Whose streets? Our streets."
Yes, exactly. And so this is a deeply problematic development. And Trump's changes are actually incredibly minimal. The Obama administration after Ferguson was pressured to restrict some of the kinds of military hardware. But basically, he said you can't have bayonets, you can't have actual tanks with tracks on them, and you can't have camouflage uniforms anymore. That's it. You can still have grenade launchers. You can still have armored personnel carriers as long as they have wheels instead of tracks and mine-resistant vehicles and night vision scopes and ballistic hardware, you know, and high-grade ammunition. I think he also restricted anything that was 50 calibers or above was too big. But anything else is fine, AR-15s and this sort of thing. So the Trump changes are largely symbolic by reallowing this stuff, and many police departments have come out publicly and said, we don't want that stuff. Civilian policing shouldn't have that stuff. So it's more about a theater of empowering the police than any actual changes in policing. But we're certainly, it's a step backwards in calling into question the fundamental nature and direction of policing right now.
I'm just curious, the funding, the amount of funding that goes to the police, I know it probably varies widely between municipalities and states, but do we see the police departments being defunded? Is that happening?
Right. So just the opposite. The police department, there's always money for more police,
right?
I often say. I mean, there are exceptions here or there. There's always money for more prisons, if that's the political priority. And this transformation, you know, there's nothing particularly rational about it. It's not cost effective. It doesn't produce justice. It's about managing inequality. And so there is always a willingness to spend money on these social control mechanisms rather than social programs. And when you have an economic system that says that wealth and inequality is because some people are more qualified than others, not because of the failure of market forces, then the solution is forcing those who are on the losing end to behave themselves and accept their diminished position, kind of blaming the victim. And because if we were to admit that market forces had something to do with this rise of inequality, then we'd have to do something about those market forces. And the ideology of neoliberalism does not allow for that. So instead, we need an ideology of punitiveness that says that the cause of all our problems are moral failings and individual inadequacies, and the way to manage that is through punishment and threats to force people to alter their behavior and to get with the program, to accept their position in society. And that means that problems like even homelessness and profound mental illness are not treated as problems of inadequate housing or inadequate mental health care. They're treated as problems of public disorder and criminality.
If you were to go and look at the root causes of the problems in our society, and particularly with policing, what would you be looking at if you went upstream? And if you could just outline how you would design or replace the criminal justice system, what you would have in place of that?
Well, I think let's go back to what I said before about community problem solving. We should have a policy in place that says that communities should have more power to call on government to provide a full range of services to solve community problems, which they don't have now. What they have are the police. And so the community should be able to say, what we need is community-based mental health treatment and supportive affordable housing and real summer jobs for our young people and real after-school opportunities that don't just keep them busy but help develop them as full human beings, that we try to bring these young people into society instead of pushing them out, and we give them real resources to do that. You know, we have blocks here in Brooklyn where the state of New York spends $1 million a year to incarcerate people from one single block. And the question is whether or not the community could figure out a better way to spend that $1 million than locking people up to produce safety in that community. And I'm sure that they could. Now, maybe there are a couple of homicidal rapists that they don't want to deal with, that they need them to be locked up. But a lot of these people are in for things that we could resolve without relying on police and prisons. We just need the political will to do it. And so ultimately, to get to that position, politically, we have to break the back of this neoliberal mindset that the only appropriate role for government is to subsidize the rich and penalize the poor. And we need to find a politics that does that and embrace that at the local level and the national level. And at the center of that has to be an agenda of racial justice.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
And that's it for Making Contact. If you'd like to hear more about Alex Vitale's work or learn more about the Upstream podcast, please visit our site, radioproject.org. Special thanks to the co-producers Della Duncan and Robert Raymond of the Upstream podcast for allowing us to broadcast an abridged version of the conversation.
You know, we heard these booms, these really loud booms. I think it was like 2 or 3 of them. And we immediately started to tell everyone, get inside.
Approximately 6:35, there was an explosion of some type at the Chevron refinery in Richmond.
This is Making Contact, and I'm Laura Flynn.
Making contact.
No one really wants to live next door to an oil refinery or a landfill or a pig farm or a waste treatment site. But if not in my backyard, then whose? You've heard it before, NIMBY. Here's NYU historian Kim Phillips Fine explaining to WNYC the origins of the term.
The first times that people talked about NIMBY struggles really had to do with the mostly working class, middle class communities protesting the location of toxic waste disposal plants and nuclear power plants, and especially in the wake of the Love Canal and Three Mile Island disasters of the late 70s and early 80s.
Researchers at the University of Michigan and the University of Montana found a pattern of doing just that. Analyzing 30 years of demographic data and the placement of hazardous facilities, the researchers wrote, quote, NIMBYism in more affluent white communities resulted in industry taking the path of least resistance and targeting communities with fewer resources and political clout. On this edition of Making Contact, we'll meet people challenging polluters in their own backyard. These communities aren't trying to push hazardous industries into another neighborhood. Instead, they're developing visionary solutions for a better life for all and for the future of the planet. There's an area along California's Northeast San Francisco Bay known as the Refinery Corridor. It's home to 5 petroleum refineries. Hazardous emissions from these refineries degrade local air quality, placing nearby residents at greater risk of cancer and other health effects. In 2014, Idle No More SF Bay, a group of Native Americans and allies, decided it was time to raise awareness about the health and environmental impacts these refineries cause. Knowing firsthand what it's like to live in a refinery town, Isabella Zizi was inspired to get involved. This next story is about her journey from one refinery town to the next.
It's honestly bringing back some memories. It might be triggering for me when I really explain how the day went. It was a really beautiful day. There was no clouds. The sky was just blue. The sun was up and shining, and it was beautiful enough for all of my family and a bunch of my neighbors to be outside just enjoying company. All of a sudden, I had noticed just this instance of darkness, and I had asked my mom. I was like, what is that? And so she turned around really quickly and she did this really big gasp. Like, you know, we all just didn't know what happened. And so she immediately said, that's Chevron that just exploded.
Hey, Chevron.
Hello, we have a fire in our process unit.
At that moment, none of us knew what to do. You know, we just see this big roar of a black cloud just shoot straight up in the air, you know, with multiple big clouds following it. And, you know, we heard these booms, these really loud booms. I think it was like 2 or 3 of them. And we immediately started to tell everyone, get inside.
Approximately 6:35, there was an explosion of some type at the Chevron refinery in Richmond.
And, you know, just watching it from my windows, just see the clouds just continue to cover the sky and the flares just shoot up. And now people like me who remember that day, I have to fear every day. Am I going to see another explosion in my lifetime? I really hope not.
You see, I grew up near the Chevron Richmond refinery in California. In 2012, a ruptured pipe at the refinery caused a fire, sending black smoke into the surrounding areas. It took more than 4 hours to bring the fire under control. Richmond lies in what's known as the Refinery Corridor. There are 5 petroleum refineries along the north coast of the East Bay, less than 30 miles from each other. So those of us who live along this oil artery are all too familiar with the trends of having a petroleum processing plant as our neighbor.
That was the biggest flare I have ever witnessed.
That's Daniel Adele. He lives in Benicia. That's in the refinery corridor too. Flaring is a process that typically burns off excess hydrocarbon gases or pressure.
It was a really windy day, and the smoke coming out of the refinery was blowing northeast away from where most of the residents live, so we were very lucky.
On May 5th, 2017, the Valero refinery in Benicia started flaring at about 6:40 a.m. The EPA found toxic gases, such as hydrogen sulfide, peaking at more than 10 times the normal for the area. The Bay Area Air Quality Management District has launched an investigation, and the Valero refinery was issued 4 notices of violations. I met Daniel a few years ago at the refinery healing walks. These are walks led by Native Americans in prayer from one refinery town to the next.
As we looked around our communities, many of us live in Richmond and other refinery towns, and we really started taking a bigger look at what it looked like, what it felt like, what the health impacts were and the emotional impacts were of living in refinery towns along the refinery corridor.
Allison Ihara Brown is a member of the Mohawk and Seneca tribes. She's a longtime Richmond resident who also helped envision the refinery healing walks in 2014.
Coming together both in terms of our indigenous values around the land and the water and the air and all of life being sacred, and also the concrete experiences of having refineries that would explode and put out flares and emissions. It's been a long period of time for all of us, I think, of really struggling to have independent towns in the midst of a gigantic worldwide corporate industry that wields tremendous power and has tremendous resources to get their way.
Inspired by the tar sands healing walk in Canada, Indigenous grandmothers started the refinery healing walks to walk for clean air, water, and soil. That's what inspired me to get involved. Now, 4 years down the road, our mission to wholeheartedly connect with other community members who live in or around refinery towns like mine is stronger than ever, something Daniel and Allison relate to, too.
Growing up here, I never really felt very isolated living over here. And even though, like, we have our own share of problems, like, the refinery corridor healing walks, they were really the first, it was really the first time that I felt, you know, people were bringing awareness to what was going on in my immediate surroundings. Mm-hmm. And it's just really inspiring to be walking with folks who are walking in commitment to the sacred system of life on our planet.
It feels really different now. It feels like we have a whole movement of people that are united around wanting a healthy, vibrant future for our communities and for our children, where we can see that what we're facing, whether we're in Pittsburgh or Rodeo or Benicia or Richmond, that what we're up against is very similar. And so I think there's a sense of community and community between cities and showing up at each other's struggles in city hall meetings or things like that. That just feels different. I think we none of us feel as isolated as we did before, and we feel more powerful.
Paul, take us away. Hey, 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 yucky.
Refinery healing walks connect the dots between five refinery towns: Pittsburgh, Martinez, Benicia, Rodeo, and Richmond. Every walk starts with a water ceremony where water from different watersheds are gathered together in a pail. Then grandmothers from Idle No More SF Bay lead everyone in prayer.
We had just walked past the north gate of the entrance to Shell Refinery here in Martinez. I am in the front with those who are carrying the head staff and the pail of water that we collected from different watersheds. And up here, this is the prayerful part where everyone is in contemplation and in prayer and in song, as you hear in the background the drums and the rattles, to keep our strong presence while we're walking.
We are currently walking over the bridge, and there are many walkers who are holding signs that read, "Walk for clean air, clean energy, water is life." There's about 100 people here. Bikers and drivers passing by also shout and honk in support as we walk along. The walk continues on for a few more miles before we reach our final destination in Benicia. A group of smiling faces greet us, high-fiving us as we form our last circle. Then we end our day by creating envisioning squares.
My name is Rich, and we've set these squares of fabrics, so that as people have come off of the walk and have in their mind ideas about a world that could be without fossil fuels, with new kinds of energy, wind, solar, much more understanding and justice and all the other wonderful things that we stand for in this healing walk, mm-hmm. that they can express this in some artistic form in these squares.
My name is Donovan. My vision for this walk is empowering the youth and the people around me the younger audience, like the kids here, being part of this movement where, you know, they're going to grow up and remember that they did something positive, not only for just for climate, but for themselves, and feel like they've been a part of history.
Sego, Patricia Tano, Ikok Peshni Ichiwi Yunyats. Patricia Sainosh is my name. Well, my vision is that we reimagine the world in the way that it was originally designed to be, and that our relationships reflect that, and our life ways respond to that inclination. We have the map, we have the instructions. So my vision is that we use them and follow them.
People gonna rise like the water. We're gonna calm this crisis down. I hear the voice of my great-granddaughter singing, keep it in the ground.
I envision a world where we are balanced with Mother Earth and use her natural resources rather than abuse or overuse them. I envision life to be free of pollution, imperialism, and destruction of humankind, and that we work together to build a solid platform of sustainable living. These intentions and drawings will be sewn together and turned into a beautiful quilt that will be displayed in community centers, libraries, and more. The hope is others will be inspired by them too. From Richmond, California, Huchin Ohlone Territory, I'm Isabella Zizi, Northern Cheyenne, Arikaraa, and Muscogee Creek, a Making Contact Community Storytelling Fellow.
After the break, we'll learn about a community organizing against the expansion of a landfill that could threaten a local watershed. We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to download shows or get our podcast, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Penobscot Nation lives on the river that shares their name. Just upstream from their island reservation is Juniper Ridge, Maine's largest landfill and the only one that's state-owned. Casella, the corporation operating the landfill, wants to double its size. Penobscots, who rely on river fish as a culturally important food source, are worried about the river being polluted by the growing dump. Along with their neighbors, they've been fighting to halt the expansion. In the process, they've exposed some backroom dealings that have paved the way for the landfill's continued growth. Megan LaSala and Lisa Bartfight bring you this next story.
Nibi gazelle moon apa kachi wuli wuni nibi kachi da ni da hamu bena. I've been here. All my ancestors have, this is all we've ever known, is this river and the land and everything around it, and that's really strong for the spirit.
Kathy Paul is a Penobscot tribal elder. She lives on an island reservation in the middle of the river that shares their name, Penobscot. The river flows from the mountains and lakes of northern central Maine all the way to the Atlantic.
Water has memory, water has life, water is life, and it is a lot stronger and more powerful than we give it credit.
Paul says she's a water protector.
When Juniper Ridge was being built, I could smell it at night. I could smell. It would wake me up. I could smell it. And I was angry. What's it going to do to my lungs? What am I breathing in, you know?
It's Maine's largest landfill, and it's just a few miles away from the Penobscot Reservation where Paul lives. The landfill has been controversial since the state of Maine purchased it in 2003. The company that operates the landfill, Casella Waste Systems, wants to double the landfill's size. This raises concerns for Paul and other tribal members.
Well, there's a potential for a direct impact.
That's John Banks. He's the director of the Penobscot Nation's Natural Resource Department.
The Penobscot Nation tribal members have sustenance fishing rights. which they've fought very hard for and reserved through various treaties starting in the 1700s, and were promised by all of the governments that signed these treaties that the fishing privileges of the Penobscot Indians would be protected in perpetuity.
But what good are those rights if the river is so poisoned you can't eat the fish? The mercury and dioxin levels in the water are already so high that tribal members can't eat more than 1 to 2 fish meals a month. They worry that the expansion of this landfill will make it even worse.
So any project like this that threatens to really trash the ecological integrity of the watershed in which it sits would have a potentially profound impact on the tribe's ability to exercise its treaty reserved fishing rights.
Actually, let me show you. I'll show you the document archives over here.
Penobscot tribal members aren't the only ones concerned. Other neighbors worry about the environmental impacts too, and they're questioning the need for this dump in the first place. Ed Spencer is a logger and a local landowner. In the last 15 years, Spencer has watched his town go from a paper mill town to a dump town. He worries about the impact that has on his livelihood, property value, and the environment.
So this is all
this
dump
is strictly,
related.
Yeah, that pile there. These are old newspapers.
Spencer has stacks of documents and file cabinets that reach from floor to ceiling, all containing information related to the dump. Along with a group of his neighbors, he's been tracking the development of Juniper Ridge Landfill since the local paper mill sold it to the state in 2003.
So the idea would be that the state would own it, own the landfill, and they would have someone else operate it. Well, it was kind of an afterthought that they put out a request for proposals for an operator. So all along it was Casella and GP and the state working to set up the deal so Casella would be the operator.
Casella is a publicly traded waste management company that does business all over New England. Casella was the only bidder on the contract to run the dump. A Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, request revealed that Casella had been at the table when the state of Maine drafted the laws that regulate the dump, giving them what some say is a big advantage.
Casella got the big windfall. They got the 30-year contract.
Paul Schroeder is a retired university librarian. He helped Ed Spencer write the FOIA requests.
Basically, carte blanche to operate the landfill to 30 million tons capacity. We figured, and it's been in the paper, you know, other people figured it, this deal was worth at least $1 billion to Casella.
This is also a matter of transparency. The state never held a local public hearing or meeting until after it had already passed a law in order to purchase the landfill. The 30-year contract the state signed with Casella makes it hard for legislators to pass regulations that threaten the company's bottom line.
I'm concerned about how these decisions are made. And, you know, that's my interest. You know, they say NIMBY, you don't want it in your backyard. I don't want bad government in my backyard.
John Banks, the director of Penobscot Nation's Natural Resource Department, is also worried about how decisions to expand the dump are made.
It's a short-term solution that's politically acceptable.
Banks' first concern is the long-term water quality. Legally, Casella has responsibility for leaks or environmental impacts for 30 years after the dump closes down. And even the EPA acknowledges that all landfills eventually leak.
You know, we're really concerned about the impacts to the water. It's right in the middle of a couple of streams that flow right into the Penobscot River. And we have been doing some independent monitoring on those streams to see if there's any change in the water quality. And so far, things, we haven't noticed any real problems. But as I said, that thing is so huge, it's going to cause problems. There's no question.
One potential problem is the leachate. Leachate is liquid that passes through a landfill and pools at the bottom. It contains the chemicals and toxins of the stuff that it passes through. The leachate from Juniper Ridge is piped out, treated, and then released into the Penobscot River, less than a mile from the reservation.
And they've assured us that it's all being treated properly and it's not resulting in any big changes in the river water quality. But we're going to check that out ourselves eventually, just to be sure. We like to kind of look over their shoulder.
The tribe's concerns about the impacts of the dump are shared by their neighbors as well. Public pressure against the dump expansion is building. There was a public hearing in October of 2016 where residents voiced their opinions about the issue. Cheryl Spencer is married to Ed Spencer, the logger we heard from earlier. This is her at the hearing.
I was kneeling in my garden weeding when the familiar smell came, and I tried one more time to ignore it. Then the asthmatic response came. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't get up.
Many people spoke out against the dump that night, but a lot of people were in favor, too.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Kenny Chamberlain, and I'm proud to say that I'm just a humble truck driver. I think it's in a good location, and if we don't expand the landfill, like a few other people said, the trash still needs to go somewhere. If we send it somewhere else, it might be out of state, which is going to drive a lot of prices up, and it's going to ship a lot of jobs out of the state, and it's going to shut down another business in the state of Maine, which is something that none of us want.
Others agree with Kenny Chamberlain, who we just heard, and want to see the landfill grow because it could mean job security for those who do business with Juniper Ridge.
Well, the big thing they'd be up against is if this doesn't expand, where's the next dump going?
Bob Duchesne is the Democratic Maine House representative for the district that Juniper Ridge is in. The landfill is expected to reach capacity by 2019 if it doesn't expand. Doubling it will extend the landfill's capacity by 8 to 10 years. Even though Duchesne has been critical of the dump at times, he's urging people to look at the big picture.
And you'd run into the same not-in-my-backyard problems anywhere else you put it. One of the reasons that we had difficulty with solid waste in the late 80s and early 90s was that we created a waste management agency to go site the next state-owned landfill, and they discovered, probably researched over 30 sites around the state, and they couldn't site one anywhere. These are not easy to site.
But are Casella and the state doing all they can to maximize Juniper Ridge's current capacity? And if the landfill expansion is granted, what happens after it maxes out?
And so a lot of this has to be a regional solution.
Ryan Parker is a policy expert with the Natural Resources Council of Maine, a conservation organization that's also opposed to the growth of Juniper Ridge. He and most of the activists that I talked to say that out-of-state trash is a really big issue. At least a quarter of the waste at Juniper Ridge comes from out-of-state, according to the most recent data available. There's a law called Title 38, which states that only trash from Maine is supposed to go there. Parker explains.
So that's one of the big problems, is that under Title 38, Section 11, waste that's generated outside of the state is counted as waste that's generated inside the state. And I haven't talked to a single person ever that thinks that makes sense, except for the people who work for Casella, who accept this waste at Juniper Ridge.
How does trash from Massachusetts get classified as Maine trash? It gets sent to a processing facility in Maine, which sorts waste and pulls out recyclables. And just like that, it's the property of a Maine-based company, Maine Trash. This works well for Casella, which needs a steady influx of waste to turn a profit.
And as you stop the landfill expansions, it changes the economics of recycling because, you know, dumping something in a hole in the ground is just about the cheapest way you can kind of flick something off your hand.
Andy Jones is a community organizer with Maine Toxics Action Center. He's supporting the local organizing effort against the landfill development. The only way to stop it, according to Jones, is to think big.
So yeah, zero waste is kind of like the visionary solution, but until that happens, we need to be, in my opinion, stopping landfill expansion.
Community members have already successfully slowed the build-out of this landfill. They believe that in buying time, they can shift the balance of power back to the people. And they're not about to give up, because as water protector Kathy Paul sees it, too much is at stake.
It's my duty. It's my responsibility as an elder to protect the land for my children and their children. Because when I think about my daughter and her kids, what's it going to be like for them?
The community is fighting for a seat at the table because they're living with the consequences and will continue to long after the dump closes. Taking the long view, residents are looking for regional solutions to the trash problem. But as local activists point out, visionary solutions will only be heard if people and not profit are at the center. In Old Town, Maine, I'm Megan LaSala for Making Contact.
On June 1st, the Maine Board of Environmental Protection approved the expansion of the Juniper Ridge landfill. Organizers expect the landfill operator, Casella, will come back in the coming years to push for further expansion. For community activists, this isn't just about the landfill expansion, it's about the culture of dumping on rural communities. That fight, based on the organizing we hear about in this story, is still happening. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Is your community fighting to protect public health and the environment? Share your story with us. Send it to us on Facebook or on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Special thanks to the Christensen Fund for supporting our Native American Storytelling Fellowship. For more information about Making Contact, go to radioproject.org. That's also where you can get our podcasts, download past shows, and make a difference by supporting our work. I'm Laura Flynn. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
KBOO Radio builds media makers. We believe strong, resilient communities must know how to make their own media. For the last 50 years, KBOO has trained thousands of people how to produce compelling radio. We know that with our expertise and your support, we can keep this city activated and aware through radio. Invest in Portland's future media makers and join KBOO on Kickstarter today.